Mexico, our people represent roughly 10% of the population, but we account for over 55% of all the COVID cases.
I feel like that's a robbery that's going on, and the people are being robbed of the basic necessities they need to survive this pandemic.
They've been attacked, killed, imprisoned. I mean, it's never stopped. COVID don't do it any better.
Because there is this desire to see us eliminated and erased entirely. I'm sorry, not sorry. We survive genocide every day.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates focused on COVID-19 and the many ways in which this pandemic touches people's lives. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. In today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, we speak with Jean Roach and Natalie Stites-Means about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on Indigenous peoples of the Dakotas. Workers at a Tesla plant in California are denouncing health and safety violations, the lack of personal protective equipment, and a general lack of concern about working conditions during the pandemic. And Puerto Rican independence leader and former political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera discusses resistance and resilience in the context of the people's struggle for sovereignty and self-determination. All this and more. But first, the news with Maeve Conran from Pacifica Radio affiliate KGNU 88.5 FM in Boulder and 1390 AM in Denver, Colorado.
500,000 people have died worldwide of the coronavirus, with more than 10 million confirmed cases globally. More than a quarter of the deaths have been in the United States, where states are continuing to reopen. According to the World Health Organization, the US has seen more than 125,000 deaths and nearly 2.5 million confirmed cases. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said today that the US is seeing more community spread of the virus. He says this is a recipe for disaster. He urged people to maintain social distancing and to wear masks in public. Other countries are also seeing an increase in cases. Iran recorded its highest daily death toll today since the outbreak began in February. The country's health ministry reports that 162 people died today and their overall official death toll is more than 10,600. The Supreme Court has struck down a Louisiana law regulating abortion clinics. Today's ruling strikes down a 2014 law requiring any doctor in Louisiana offering abortion services to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles. Opponents say this would have left only one doctor at a single clinic to provide abortion services for the entire state. The Supreme Court struck down a similar law in Texas in 2016. Justice John Roberts sided with the four more liberal justices on the court in today's ruling, saying that he thought the court was wrong to strike down the Texas law, but that it had set binding precedent. Today's ruling gives hope to reproductive rights activists who are fighting a wave of more restrictive abortion laws being enacted around the country. During the COVID-19 pandemic, eight states have sought to heavily restrict abortions, categorizing them as elective procedures. Alabama, Arkansas, Iowa, Louisiana, Ohio, Tennessee, and West Virginia enacted intermittent bans on abortion during the pandemic, saying they were non-essential elective procedures. Thousands of protesters gathered on Saturday afternoon in Aurora, Colorado, demanding justice in the case of Elijah McClain, who died after being detained by police in August 2019. Protesters shut down a highway north of Denver, and later a violin vigil took place honoring McClain, who played the instrument, in a scene which dramatically juxtaposed with the riot police, which came to break up the protest. Mm-hmm. Elijah McLean, a 23-year-old black man, died in August 2019 after being stopped by police for no criminal reason. A caller to 911 reported that a man was dancing to music while wearing a ski mask. McLean, a massage therapist who was unarmed and on his way home from a convenience store, was put in a chokehold and given ketamine. He then suffered two heart attacks on the way to hospital. He was pronounced brain dead 6 days later. The three officers involved were never charged. Elijah McLean's death has seen renewed interest in the recent protests after the killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis. Last week, Colorado Governor Jared Polis appointed the state attorney general to lead an independent investigation into the case. For Pacifica Radio, this was Maeve Conran from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado.
You are listening to COVID, Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. We stopped this hour to discuss the effects of COVID-19 on Indigenous peoples with a focus on the Dakotas. Pleased to be joined by Jean Roach and Natalie Stites-Means for this important conversation. Jean Roach is Minikoju Lakota and a board member of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, as well as a grassroots organizer. Natalie Stites-Means founded a civic engagement effort last year that morphed into a grassroots COVID-19 community response mutual aid effort in Rapid City, South Dakota. She is Lakota and Dakota and enrolled with Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. Welcome, Jean and Natalie.
Thank you.
After the initial silence that bordered on cover-ups, we finally got the numbers that show the disproportionate impact on the health of Black people and the dismal response of the U.S. government and local government in cities across the United States. We haven't heard as much about the impact on Indigenous communities and the response of the U.S. government. What is happening in the Rapid City area, Natalie?
Well, we recently had our local Indian health service provider, the Oyate Health Center, release data that indicated we are half of the numbers of COVID-19 positive cases in Pennington County, which is the name of the county that Rapid City is a part of. And since May 10th, we have been responding to the families who are positive with COVID and need to quarantine, providing them with homemade and cooked meals. Approximately 1,100 meals have been delivered to families in quarantine. 26 families that, you know, we've been serving since May 10th, not the same families, but rather those going on and off of quarantine. And the dismal response here in South Dakota, you know, includes Black people, Black immigrants, African Americans on what we call East River, and that is in the Sioux Falls area. Rapid City is sort of the capital of the West River area. Here in Western South Dakota. And we're finding that in terms of actual services and direct assistance to families who are experiencing COVID-19, we're finding very little resources available to them to quarantine, to have food, basic necessities, and supplies at their homes or even in their hotel rooms. And recently, we're going the closure of our pop-up shelter for COVID-19 patients was announced that it would be closing, and we're going to see really an extreme limitation in services available to COVID-19 positive families.
That is heartbreaking news, really. And it also is nothing new in terms of the ways that the U.S. government and even local governments within the U.S. have mistreated and really abused and acted in exploitative ways towards our Indigenous siblings. And also, we continue to demonstrate resistance and resilience. And so how are Indigenous communities continuing to demonstrate that resistance and resilience that is the legacy of Indigenous people in the United States?
You know, certainly we have survived and persisted for hundreds of years because we have turned to each other during times of crisis and disaster. And often, you know, created by the very people who are colonizing and settling our homelands. And I think that this mutual aid effort that we're doing is basically is about taking care of ourselves, of natives, helping natives to recover and to survive this pandemic. We have feckless, irresponsible state and local leaders more interested in tourism and in the economic part of it, just like we're seeing in a lot of different states and at the national level. And, you know, we're seeing the real life impacts on people who have COVID. And I feel like it's a robbery that's going on. And the people are being robbed of the basic necessities they need to survive this pandemic. And, you know, in recognition of that effort, we're coming to each other's aid once again in order to survive a pandemic. You know, we've seen jokes from local leaders, business leaders around come into the smallpox blanket. And those old metaphors about our previous experiences with diseases and epidemics. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that being used in a racist way towards local Native Americans here in this region. And I think that overcoming that and resisting that, surviving that, because there is this desire to see us eliminated and erased entirely. And, you know, and sorry, not sorry, we survive genocide every day.
A lot of Native Americans have underlying health conditions, which include, you know, diabetes, high blood pressure, it goes on and on. But in this pandemic, the people that are inside the prisons who have actually no access to health care, like Leonard Peltier, who's been in there with an anorectic aneurysm, he's been waiting for medical care. And at the same time, the racism that exists against Native people that actually pushes them to the very sideways, so they're not even acknowledged. And when we try to support our people, the access to the information is hard for us to get. The Bureau of Prisons, you know, they tend to keep stuff. If you ask for medical records, so you can prove the underlying conditions that as part of the release of people due to COVID, you know, there's no answer. They don't release the prison records, which like Leonard's been in there almost, you know, over 45 years, and all his different conditions, you know, the medical records are just hard to get. I mean, 2 years, really, if I needed my medical records, I need them tomorrow. You know what I mean? And the food that they're given does not address, you know, the needs of our bodies for anybody, no matter who they are, you know. It's just like they put them in the prison and they would be satisfied to give them bread and water, which is basically, you know, what they're giving them is a real high-carb diet. And it's not good for people that have diabetes. But not only that, you know, the my sister's been in there for 23 years in the women's federal prison, and to get the same thing with her, we can't get her access to medical records or even good health care. So it's just like whenever Obama went out and they did a lot of clemencies, there was no Native Americans on that list. You know, we've been pushed down by the society, and we've been genocidal attacks on us since day one when whoever the conquistadors or Columbus came. You know, they did away with a lot of our good foods that we've had before, you know, our sovereign natural foods. So one of the things, not to change the subject, but back to what we're doing in Rapid City, is incorporating our natural foods and our prayer and our beliefs about our Mother Earth. And that's real important right now, that people relate back to our historical connections to the earth with the medicines and the things that help us heal, you know, not only your mind, body, and soul. But that's part of the whole genocide that's happened, and we have all these political prisoners that have been coming since Sitting Bull, you know. They've been attacked, killed, imprisoned. I mean, it's never stopped. you know. So when you have all these people in prison that just because they have no access to, you know, the things that people with money do, basically, or people go to prison on alarming rates, and COVID don't do it any better. You know, there hasn't been any relief for our prisoners on all levels, state, federal, you know, you even have tribal.
You mentioned our elder, Leonard Peltier. Of course, there are folks like him who have spent decades, I mean, 3 and 4 decades, 30, 40 years, like Rochelle McGee, who, you know, often spent most of that time in solitary confinement, who are not being released, even as we see other folks, for example, friends of this administration who are being released based upon COVID-19. And so we'd be remiss not to talk about our elder Leonard Peltier and the global demand for his release. How is our elder and how do folks join the fight to have him released?
We have several things going on. One is a clemency bid from Trump that's being submitted. We also have, you know, the attorney, I think it was a Barr, that released the information of how federal prisoners can be released based on underlying health conditions. Now, Leonard meets all this. Not only that, you know, his whole history of his case is so obnoxious because, you know, it's an assault to our intelligence, the way the FBI and the United States government has attacked him based on COINTELPRO, which is actually a program used against a lot of people of color. You know, they have the Black Panthers that they attacked through that. So this story doesn't just stick with Native Americans. And COVID kind of looks like a weapon to me, but I'm not sure, you know, because they're using it to let the disease kill our people without giving us adequate health care, which has always been their weapon. But right now, if we start helping each other and reconnect back to reality, you know, that, you know, Mother Earth is the one that will, so that supports us, and we have to respect her in a way that we can all survive together.
Yeah, that's the only way that this is going to work. That's the only way. Natalie, if folks want to support the work that you're doing, there may be people who want to donate funds to be of assistance. There may be people who want to make calls to whoever they need to call to get this money to folks and to get the assistance to our Indigenous siblings. How do they get connected up with you and with your work?
You know, I'm no millennial, I'm 44, so we're doing most of our organizing through Facebook and through Messenger chat, as well as through our group, Meals for Relatives, COVID-19 Rapid City Community Response. And so Facebook is really the easiest way, and you're free to, you know, contact myself or Jean Roach and help to contribute. We really do have like a national base of people who are donating and sending supplies, and so we wouldn't be able to do it without the outside help coming in from outside Rapid City and South Dakota in order to serve our people. So, and we do have a PayPal account, also a campaign, Meals for Relatives, COVID-19 Community Response. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. And Jean, if folks want to help to push the work to get our elder Leonard Peltier out of prison and to have him be free with us who love him so much, how do we do that? How do we connect up with that work?
We also do a Facebook page. It's called International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. And we do Twitter at Peltier HQ. And we also have a website, whoisleonardpeltier.info.
To listen to our full interview with Jean Roach and Natalie Stites-Means, visit our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.
Loan me a minute, let me borrow your ear. I'll sing you a song about Leonard Peltier. He's gone so long in a federal jail, the innocent victim of a tangled tale. In South Dakota, where the fear has grown, the president's a watch from a mountain of stone. They say all people are free to roam. There ain't no freedom in the Indian home. How many have gone before? And tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian war? The company spoke to the high command. We need the deeds to the Indian land to dig for oil and uranium ore. Maybe have to start a little Indian war. The orders came from away on high, and if there was a job for the FBI, it won't be hard. All we'll have to do is just cause a little trouble and follow it through. Oglala, where the spirit did dwell, it was a time they remember well. There were women and children gathered there when the wind blew a warning through the whispering air. And Leonard Peltier was one of those who came to the call when the time arose. And dangerous strangers were prowling around, bringing trouble to the reservation ground. And that was when the agents made their play in a gunshot battle on a deadly day. And three men died in the hollow sand, two FBI and an Indian man. How many have gone before? And tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian war? Joe Stunts was a man that died that day, but the eyes of the law didn't see it that way. All they cared about was their own kind, gonna get somebody for a capital crime. The charge was set for homicide, but Leonard got away to the Canada side, where he lived for a while in the northern town, till they came up and got him and brought him back down. Judge and the jury, they both agreed, 2 times murder in the first degree. They pounded the gavel and they rang on the bell, 2 times life in a federal cell. Citations came from Washington, congratulations on a job well done, 2 agents gone is a mighty price.
Welcome back to Pacifica's national broadcast, COVID, Race, and Democracy. I am Nana Jumphy. We continue to explore how the COVID-19 pandemic is impacting Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations in the United States. Let's get this update from American Indian Airwaves, a show that airs on Pacifica Radio, KPFK, in Los Angeles.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves on how COVID-19 is impacting Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations. With 574 federally recognized Native American nations within the United States, and as part of the U.S. government's treaty obligations and trust responsibilities to provide adequate health care to Native Americans, I speak with Stacy Bullen. She's a member of the Sault Ste. Marie Chippewa or Anishinaabe Nation, and she's Chief Executive Officer of the National Indian Health Board, a Washington, D.C.-based organization that works with federally recognized Native American nations that have and operate their own health care system, as well as the Indian Health Services, a federal agency responsible for providing health care to Native American citizens. And now, this is Stacy Bullen providing us an update on how COVID-19 is impacting federally recognized Native American nations and their citizens.
First of all, thank you for having me and the National Indian Health Board discuss this today. Pleased to be here. As of June 8th, the Indian Health Service reported nearly 13,500 positive cases, but the numbers are highly likely to be underestimates because case reporting by tribal health programs, which constitutes about two-thirds of the entire Indian health system, are voluntary. As we know, last month the Navajo Nation surpassed New York City for the highest COVID-19 infection rates, but we found out that through study at UCLA, Center for American Indian Health Research, that if tribes were treated like states, the top five COVID-19 areas of incidence and prevalence would all be tribal nations, number one of them being Mississippi Choctaw, which nobody would have expected because you never see it in the media. Navajo Nation is number five in that top five. Among them are two Pueblos and White Mountain Apache. As well, in New Mexico, our people represent roughly 10% of the population, but we account for over 55% of all the COVID cases. And as of June 7th, our people account for nearly 34% of all the COVID-19 cases in the state of Wyoming, but we're only 2.9% of the population. Similar statistics are in Montana, where our people are just 6.5% of the state population, but we're 12% of the confirmed COVID-19 cases. It's just not acceptable.
And some of the causal factors, and I realize that's a loaded question, but some of the causal factors in terms of why there's such a lack of infrastructure and resources for Indigenous nations and Indian health services to appropriately care and provide the services that are needed for Indigenous peoples that are testing positive for COVID-19, or just simply the community members that haven't been tested yet that could possibly be carriers or infected with COVID-19.
Well, this is not new. It's just that it's like the branch that's been lying in the field for years and years, and when you pull it up and find out what's under it, you're shocked. But this infrastructure challenge in Indian country, this is not new, and it is not accidental. This is a consequence of hundreds of years of neglect, overt interference, and suppression of American Indian and Alaska Native people, and then the lack of will and action on the part of the federal government to honor the trust responsibility and really fund the Native treaty rights and our trust responsibility that we've established in the federal government to provide health care for our people in a way that a mainstream American would be satisfied with. That's not what's happening in Indian country. It's never been happening in Indian country. And the incident of COVID-19 now being upon us simply pulls that branch back. It pulls the veil back. And now all of America can see what we've been living with every day.
Your thoughts on the CARES Act and the allocation of funding, and I know part of the CARES Act was an allocation of little over $1 billion for Indian health services. And I recall you testifying, I recall a statement by you earlier in the year saying that even with that funding, it would only increase from 16 cents to 23 cents on every dollar that the U.S. government is obligated to spend as part of its treaty obligations and its trust responsibility to Indigenous nations. Your thoughts?
Yes, I did say that. And yes, that is true. Let me talk specifically about COVID-19. Now, let me put this into context. When the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention comes out with a list of ways to best protect oneself from acquiring COVID-19. The number one thing on that list is wash your hands frequently. Great. If you're 40% of the population of Navajo Nation or 60% of the population in Alaska or other percentages in other areas of Indian country, and you do not have running water in your home, how are you able to enjoy the infrastructure that is already in place before there's an emergency so that you can do the number one thing you need to do to protect yourself? So when I say we're very grateful for the $2.4 billion that have come into the Indian health system in the last 4 months to help fight COVID-19 for Indian country, we're grateful for the 220 million that came through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We understand that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has put additional funds into Indian Country, $100 million and more, just for the healthcare system and to help fight COVID-19. This is all progress. It's all progress, and it's all to the good. But that problem that I mentioned about water, that will cost $9 billion to address. That's what we're talking about, to make real infrastructure needed investment in Indian Country, just to bring our people up to par with what mainstream America expects and what a decent human being living in the 21st century expects. Not the human being being decent, but the circumstances under which a human being lives being decent.
And that was Stacy Bullen, Chief Executive Officer of the National Indian Health Board, providing us an update on how COVID-19 is impacting federally recognized Native American nations and their citizens. That concludes this segment of American Indian Airwaves and how COVID-19 is impacting Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations. I've been your host, Larry Smith. Until next time.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Workers at a Tesla plant in California are denouncing health and safety violations and a lack of personal protective equipment, as well as the general lack of concern from management about COVID-19. Steve Zeltzer has the details.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica. The attack on workers and the health and safety of workers around the country is growing as the pandemic and epidemic spreads. One of the workers who has spoken out around this issue is Carlos Gabriel, who's a Tesla worker in Fremont, California. And he has led the campaign for proper health and safety at the plant at Tesla and has also been retaliated against for speaking out.
You know, going back even before it hit the U.S., Elon Musk calling it dumb or the worry about it dumb, even though, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people are dying from this disease. And, you know, initially they refused to close. They deemed themselves critical infrastructure. And even though the county in which, Alameda County, in which the factory is at, had a shelter in place, you know, Tesla refused to close down or shut down their doors.
You said that there has not been an oversight of Cal/OSHA of COVID safety, health and safety at the plant. Why isn't Governor Newsom responding to the needs of the workers at Tesla and other workers at meatpacking plants? It seems like, although he's a Democrat, he seems to be carrying out the same operations as Trump, even though he says he's different than Trump as far as protecting workers in California.
I mean, I couldn't tell you what's on his mind, other than, you know, he has a very capitalistic mind where, you know, with regards to Tesla, you know, initially I felt like, you know, Governor Newsom was on our side, you know, him and other health officials, because they did listen to the workers in the community about shutting down, you know, the state and Tesla, right? But then all of a sudden they get a threat and a lawsuit by Elon Musk, and now they, you know, they're running high. They're running high. With regards to Cal/OSHA, my understanding is that, you know, there has been, you know, for years there has been more than a 52% or 50% lack of inspectors. So there has been a lot of vacancies, 50% vacancies at Cal/OSHA, which, you know, it's concerning to me as a worker and as a California resident that the organization and institution that's in charge of our health and safety, you know, the health and safety of about 20 million people in California, is underemployed and has this many vacancies, 52% vacancies in the whole state of California. It seems to me that they're functioning at the same capacity or with the same tactic that the Trump federal OSHA is functioning, and it's unacceptable. It's extremely unacceptable. I would say, you know, reach out first to Governor Newsom. as much as possible into your supervisors and to your health departments and your own communities. But also, you know, also have rallies. You know, have rallies at different government agencies, at different factories that you know for sure, like Amazon and Tracy, that we know for sure has had, you know, COVID-19, I think even deaths, right, coming from that factory. So, you know, just support your workers and hold your officials accountable. Hold these factories accountable. You know, the first thing is by contacting them via email, via phone, and just bombarding their means of communication so that they understand that this is an issue for everyone. Because I don't think it's just workers that are being affected by this. No, if one of the workers at Tesla, for example, or several of the workers at Tesla are infected with COVID-19, that can spread, again, as I said, from Santa Cruz all the way to Fresno County. That's a lot of counties in between. So it's affecting everyone. So I would say, you know, put the pressure on your supervisors, put the pressure on your mayor, on all political types, put the pressure on, especially on those that are in charge of public health.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking with Carlos Gabriel. He's a Tesla worker. And this is Steve Zelsa with Pacifica. So thanks for joining us on the show, Carlos.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza was buried on Friday, June 26th, in Burundi's capital. The president died suddenly on June 8th, reportedly of a heart attack. Pacifica's Anne Garrison has the story.
The sudden death of Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza shocked the East African nation, where he was in power from 2005 to 2015 and was loved by the rural peasant majority. Burundi's new president, Evariste Ndayishimiye, who had been elected on May 20th, was sworn in 10 days after Nkurunziza's death. Tiny Burundi is Africa's Syria and Venezuela, a developing nation that dared to raise an independent head, contracted with a Russian firm to mine its nickel reserves, then survived the ensuing sanctions, propaganda, and covert operations. Russia and China came to Burundi's aid by vetoing UN Security Council resolutions to censure it over alleged human rights abuse, which would have laid ground for a military, quote, intervention, unquote, of one sort or another. The African Union also refused to, quote, intervene, unquote. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro extended his condolences to the Burundian people, sending, quote, respect and solidarity with our brothers and sisters of Mother Africa at such a difficult time, unquote. To read the Western press and NGOs, however, one might think that Vlad the Impaler had died. I spoke to Edgar Tabaro, a Ugandan lawyer and former law professor who knew Nkurunziza personally and authored an eloquent tribute in Uganda's Observer. He declined to speculate about why the West vilified Burundi's late president, but said that the ordinary people of Burundi disagree.
I'm very certain if you went and had a discussion with an ordinary person in the gardens, in the grazing lands, in the streets in Burundi, the view would certainly be much different. It would be a total contrast to what you see being said by these international NGOs. And in any case, international NGOs have had a very frosty relationship with the authorities in Bujumbura. Why they fell out with the government there, I don't want to speculate. I can only say, comfortably, things are witnessed.
Tabaro also said that Nkurunziza had been born to privilege, but that he lived very simply, very much in touch with the masses.
He was of fairly privileged background, and I would describe him as one who belonged to the elite class. However, the way he conducted his presidency was in simplicity, very much in touch with the masses.
Like Rwanda, Burundi has suffered civil wars and genocide due to the centuries-old competition between Hutu and Tutsi. Tabaro believes that Nkurunziza's legacy will be his work to reconcile the two and end the deep-seated centuries-old hatred between them. Nkurunziza's mother was a Tutsi, his father a Hutu, and he was a Hutu because the identity transfers patrilineally from father to children. Upon coming to power, he included members of the elite Bahima Tutsi clan in his government, even though they had been responsible for Hutu genocides in 1972, 1988, and 1993.
his legacy is the reconciliatory approach, genuine reconciliatory approach that he extended towards the warring factions of Burundi and the deep-seated hatred between the ethnic groupings that had been around for centuries. The Bahima were a hegemony that ruled over Burundi, and they were responsible for the three genocides in 1972, where the entire Hutu elite were wiped out, 1988 and in 1993. And Nkurunziza did engage with these groups and never discriminated them. In fact, there was Dr. Sahinguvu. He was appointed vice president in the first government, 2005 to 2010. In 2010 and 2015, Major Busokoza, Bernard Busokoza, was appointed vice president. Major Busokoza was one of the masterminds of the coup and assassination against President Ndadaye in 1993. So he extended an olive branch to them, included them in his cabinet.
That was Edgar Tabaro, lawyer and former law professor at Uganda Christian University, on the legacy of Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. His essay, Fare Thee Well, President Nkurunziza, can be read on the websites of Uganda's Observer, observer.ug, and the San Francisco Bayview, sfbayview.com. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Stay with us. We'll be back after a short break.
Entre esas manos nos salió la patria. Gloria a las manos que las minas excavarán.
Gloria
a las manos que el ganado cuidarán.
Gloria
a las manos que el tabaco, que la caña y el café los sembrarán. Mujeres que trabajaron y gloria a las manos, a todas las manos que hoy trabajan, porque ellas construyen y saldrá de ellas la nueva patria liberada.
Alabanzas, alabanzas para ellos y para su patria. Alabanza, alabanza, alabanza.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. Puerto Rican independence leader Oscar Lopez Rivera spent over three decades as a political prisoner of the United States. His 55-year sentence was commuted by President Obama prior to leaving office in 2017. Recently, Lopez Rivera spoke at the Berkeley City College in a talk entitled Resistance and Resilience. Among other issues, Lopez Rivera addressed the importance of understanding the United States as an empire and building solidarity with independence and sovereignty struggles across the global South. Here's Oscar Lopez Rivera.
One thing about empire, you know, if we look at the beginning of the United States, 13 colonies, and we cannot forget that the space that those 13 colonies were on were native lands. And if we want to dig in a little bit into the history, it was the Iroquois who definitely allowed the Europeans who came in. They helped them with how to survive, how to plant, how to do things correctly. When we look at the size of the United States, but especially after the Spanish-American War, the United States defeated Spain in Cuba. It takes over Puerto Rico and Cuba, two Caribbean nations. It takes over the Philippines. And if anyone is interested in knowing what empire is, there are books dealing with what the United States did in the Philippines, because it was brutal, it was horrendous, and just to colonize the Filipinos. And if the slogans that were used in order to encourage the military people to do the killings and to do all these things that they did, it is worthwhile reading just what happened in the Philippines, what happened in Guam, what happened in the Marshall Islands, what happened in the different places, territories that the United States took over. We can read into guano and find out how the United States went to take over guano because it was a fertilizer. And if we go into Peru and we read about what the United States, the people who were after guano throughout the world, the one who really, really, really pushed and took over spaces that have guano. In Haiti, there's a space where the United States went and took over, and a lot of the people that, the workers that they took there, a lot of them dying just because of the conditions that were there. And in the Pacific was the same thing. So it's not only an empire, it's a super empire. When we compare what the United States has done from the 13 colonies on, we will say, yes, it's a super empire. And if we, in 1954, President Eisenhower, made a very good observation. He was a military man. And he said, the military industrial complex has to be eliminated. And this is a man who was very, very much involved in World War II. And he was the president of the United States. Making that observation should be enough for us to really think and say, why would that president of the United States be saying that? And he knew something that a lot of people try to and has been hiding over and over. Why do we have to have wars?
Oscar Lopez Rivera, speaking at Berkeley City College.
The government of Brazil under the Goulart regime was doing progressive things. They were changing, bringing Brazil into the 20th century, and all of a sudden, this move that the United States, the CIA move, and all of a sudden, the colonels in Brazil took over. And all of a sudden, everything that was positive, everything that was going good in Brazil was destroyed. And the same thing happened with Lula when he became president. The United States did not want Lula because Lula came out of the working class. And Lula was fighting for the working class. And all of a sudden, There's no way that Lula can bring back the way that Brazil was moving, and it was in a very positive way. Changes were being created. Positive changes were being created. In 1973, with the overthrow of Allende in Chile, right now with the overthrow of Evo Morales in Bolivia, Evo Morales changed Bolivia. Evo Morales put the native people in Bolivia where they should be. And the whole change of the economy, I mean, this man was transforming Bolivia, but it was contrary to the interests of the United States and those Bolivians who are not natives. And they were there, and little by little, they were able to get rid of this person. That if we listen to him, if we pay attention to him, we can say, this is a great this is a great leader. I have had the opportunity to talk with Evo Morales, and I was in prison. I was in prison when I heard Evo Morales say this thing, because he was part of this coca growers, and he went into this room where they were having this thing about drugs and cocaine, and he stepped into the room and said, "La coca no es cocaína. Coca is not cocaine, because for centuries, the natives of Bolivia use for different reasons, for different purposes, and it's not something that is harmful. They were not making cocaine; they were using the plant itself. But little by little, somebody went and little by little converted that coca leaf into cocaine." And I want to point something out that sometimes people forget. When the United States wanted to defeat the Contras in Nicaragua, the Contras were financed with coke money. They would bring cocaine, and Mena Airport in Arkansas was a place where they were bringing the coke, and at that time, Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas. They were bringing it in. Cocaine was not a drug that was being used in the poor communities because it was expensive. And all of a sudden, they brought the coke into the United States. They transformed that into crack, and crack became a very addictive drug all over the United States and probably some parts of the Caribbean too. So to finance the Contras, and that's the reality that it cannot be hidden, because they caught an airplane with the coke, and so all of a sudden it was discovered where this coke was going to be delivered, and all of a sudden we have a crisis in many, many communities because the young people were becoming crack addicts. So that's the reality that we face. There's another thing here. I would invite anyone to read Victor Marchetti's book on Vietnam. Victor Marchetti was a CIA agent. And he, all of a sudden, found out something that was happening, that Operation Phoenix was being financed with heroin. And the heroin was being, the laboratories were in Laos. They would take the processed heroin into Thailand, and from Thailand they would ship it. And when we would go into New York City, we had an epidemic of heroin, big epidemic. There's a movie called American Gangster, which is based on a real story. I was in prison with Frank Lucas, one of the persons who was involved in that, in the whole thing. And I got to meet Frank, and we talked about it. So this is something that people don't know and people don't pay attention to, but it's important, because that's how we get destroyed. That's how we, addictions are terrible. So how is it that we change this world? How is it that we work on this world? And I think there is the potential, there is the strength. If we want to find a solution, all problems created by men have a solution. We have to dare to change, or we have to change and do whatever we need to do and work as hard as we can, but we can definitely change, create at least some of the changes that we need right now, and make this a better and more just world. It's not only Puerto Rico. I'm hoping that if we do something positive with Puerto Rico, that will be an example that other countries can follow, and we will be helping to make this a better and more just world.
That was Oscar Lopez Rivera speaking at Berkeley City College on resistance and resilience. This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Paulina Vasiliev. And our executive consultant is Verna Avery Brown at WPFW. Thanks to the Pacifica National Board COVID Task Force for their contributions. And special thanks to Fernando Velasquez at KPFK for advice and support. I'm Nana Jumpfee. Thanks for listening, and make sure to tune in tomorrow.